What we've done so far is begun a conversation that, by its own definition, shouldn't be ending. A myth has no clear beginning, no ending, and living a mythic life based on any understanding of the world is meant to be an ongoing journey. In fact, according to a mythic journey, that doesn't end when we die. The mythic journey continues. There's a wonderful book up in the library by a rabbi named Elie Spitz called Does the Soul Survive? So if we're going to have this conversation with integrity, we have to acknowledge that only a fraction of it can happen in any given moment, because the next chapter will be written when we're done sitting together here. All that being said, I have a lesson plan, but I got to tell you. So, we've had, Sheldon, your comment in our first class, because I've listened to the conversation again. The first presentation was called Living a Mythic Life, Mythic Time. Sheldon sort of said quite casually something that was deeply moving to me and others' responses to others as well. He said, myth is true not because it's fact. The implication of these ideas are not based on whether or not they're objective, whether or not they're history. And that might be a basic statement for us to make, but if we don't make it, much of this conversation doesn't make any sense. We're about to enter a moment in exactly 6 days, 6 nights, in fact, which I'm not at all prepared for, and if you are, that's great. But the Seder begins Motzei Shabbat, and there is a general theme to the Seder, which is Bechol Dor Vador Chayav Adam Lirot Et Atzmo Ki'ilu Hu Yatzah Min Yitzrayim. In every generation, every single person is supposed to see themselves as if they left Egypt. So my children are beginning to get to the point where they say, oh yeah, but they did. And I say, no, we did. And then we talk about the difference between who I'm supposed to see myself as having been. There's this beautiful idea that everyone who ends up in the Jewish people, not only the people who began in it, all of our souls were present at Sinai. We knew each other then. Well, what if you wonder whether or not Sinai ever actually happened in the way that's depicted in the Torah? Does that reduce the integrity of the statement? My soul knew your soul back when. Do I need to believe in the historicity of Sinai, the historicity of the Exodus as depicted in Shemot, in Exodus? Exodus and Exodus? Do I have to believe that those are facts in order to find meaning and direction and compelling force in their communication? And the answer, I think, is no. So what we began by talking about was how myth can influence our sense of time. We also talked about how myth can influence sense of place. How when I step into this shul, I'm actually in my childhood again. I'm actually back in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle of the desert because of the construct. I'm also in a very contemporary sense of American purposefulness, because the architecture here actually cannot trace itself cleanly to the ancient tabernacle, though symbolism continues it. Our sense of space changes, and yet, when it works, I'm no longer only where I see myself as being with my eyes. My heart tells me where I am. There are people, I said this yesterday, there are people who have been taking a class called Taste of Judaism. 40 people have showed up each time. About 40. It's staggering, actually. It's very hard to have an intimate conversation with that many people, and yet it's happened almost every time. 12 of the 40 identify as Jewish. And those 12 came to the class because it was unconventionally marketed. It was put out by the Federation called Bridges to Interfaith Communities. Dawn Kepler is the professional who runs that. Some of us know her. It's incredible to see what stepping into the space did to the people who came in almost instantly. Suddenly they became more quiet. And then when whoever the presenter was, whether it was me or someone else, made a joke, the nervous laughter bubbled to the fore, because all of a sudden the holy, scary space became welcoming. But is that a function of the people in the room, or does the environment actually encourage that kind of feel? Someone walks into your home, they know they're not on the street. What about your home communicates that it's your home, not that it's a box that doesn't have wind? How do we construct the space? So we had that conversation as well. Today's topic is mythic people, which on the one hand is easier, but on the other hand is harder. So here's what I'd like to start as a paradigm for understanding it. In American culture, part of how mythic people have become understood is through comic books. There are people who are not exactly people. The best example, actually, which I wasn't planning on using, is the X-Men, for those who have followed that story. The X-Men is a story of human beings who have evolved genetically and suddenly manifest powers. What's actually incredibly moving about this for the Jewish people is that the villain named Magneto, that's his power is to have magnetic force on anything around him, any metal thing around him, he's a Holocaust survivor. And his fight within the mutant community, which is human beings who have evolved somewhat, is to not let anyone marginalize them again. So that's one sense of mythic. I have more power, and my understanding of the world influences the way that I see my responsibility to use the power. So a mythic impact can be seen through that film, though that's not the paradigm I'd like to use. Mine is a little bit older in terms of its comic book origins. Batman, Spider-Man, Superman. I'm leaving him out. He's before my time. Actually, so are all three of them. But look, I'm talking about comic books. I'm a rabbi. It's like, you know. Actually, there's a lot written about Superman as a Jewish character, that the cape is actually the talit. It's like Moses being sent. And actually, if you think about it, the two Jewish boys who created Superman had a real sense of that. Because remember, he was sent. It's not a Nile, but it's a cosmic journey wrapped in a cape, in a vessel that only he goes in and emerges to ultimately have a saving power in the world that he inherits. He's not actually part of them, but he's not part of them, and the world that he came from is destroyed. And gets adopted by somebody else. Pharaoh's daughter are the Kents. There's a lot to be understood about this, and even if we can laugh about it, because it's so mundane, it actually has deep impact. Look at what... look at what the modern reincarnations of the superheroes as the film world, as the Hollywood world, has begun to present them. They're actually quite ordinary, and the angst that they feel is something very approachable. Suddenly being a superhero is not being so distant from being a person. More than that, or deeper than that. Difference between Batman, Spider-Man, Superman. Anyone want to take a stab, and then we'll jump into some Jewish texts? A difference. Who's Batman?
Batman is a person who has no superpowers.
Batman is a person who has no superpowers, right?
This is all technology.
Right, but he uses his understanding of technology. He uses human abilities to follow his mission in the world, and of course it's born out of the murder in his face of his parents. His sense of his obsessive need to make justice happen in the world fuels human passion, creativity to an extreme, but there's nothing superhuman about him. Except that he doesn't need to sleep and knows everything. Okay, he can be... So that's... Well, one second. We're going to get to Superman. I want to go in increments, at least the way that I'm laying it out. So hold on to Superman for a second. Batman is a human being. Spider-Man. Say that again. Human, and he gets powers. In fact, if you want to see him in another mythological framework, you know, Achilles, when he is dunked by the nursemaid who cares for him into the place that makes him sort of divine, except for the heel, he becomes something other than human, but he started off that way. He suddenly acquires by external force more than human capability. So Batman is not the same as Spider-Man. Right? They're both superheroes, but what makes them super is different. Right, sense of purpose might be what connects them, but what they are is different. Superman, Martha.
Well, Superman has super time. I mean, as long as he's a normal human being, and then he has to transition into a superhero.
Okay. It's one way of understanding that he shifts between being a human being and being Superman. So Clark Kent is who he is, and Superman is who he is. But if it comes down to what he is, he's not human. He's different than human. In fact, one of the places you can see this most clearly, and no one should have to pay as much attention to this as I do, but there was about 7 years ago, a series in the Superman comic book world called The Death of Superman, where he was killed, in fact, by a monster named Doomsday. I mean, it's incredibly symbolic. And he comes back, and a cult forms around his return. And he fights off the cult. He says, that's not what this is about. It was technology. that brought him back. But the whole, it's interesting how the religious world, as it's beginning to coalesce today for us, where everything takes on significance. The shape of Jesus on a piece of toast, and I'm not saying this to insult it, inspires people. Tears from a Madonna inspire people. I remember this movie with Sean Penn and We're No Angels. It's Sean Penn and Robert De Niro, where a Madonna's crying and the whole town turns around and they end up assuming religious leadership by accident of the community. And when they realize that it's the roof leaking, it doesn't change anything for them. But suddenly these two people, who are actually criminals, that's the whole point of the film, they escape and the people think that they're priests who have come to serve the community. It's a wonderful film, by the way. But the point is that these two people, who are incredibly human, in fact, fraught with humanity, become icons and therefore conduits for purpose. Where we end up being sometimes influences our role in the world. Bruce Wayne in the Batman story was just going to be a kid. He was just going to be a very rich kid. And everything changes for him. But he doesn't lose his humanity. He just sees himself as serving a purpose that's much greater than self. He suddenly can't only be the human being he was going to be. And I think in our lives, in different frames, we find that true. We end up doing things that make no sense if we're there to serve ourselves and our sense of stability in the world. In fact, this jewel would not be, were that the case. Because for a short time, the people for whom Nitivot Shalom, before it was called that, made all the world a difference, could exist in their homes. And suddenly it became a high holiday thing that served other people. But why? Is that connected in some way to the sense of mythic purpose that a human being can embody? So, thoughts so far? Sure.
A story I heard, and I know very little about Christianity, but I have a favorite poet who's Irish Catholic, David White. And one of his tapes recently I re-listened to, and he talks about Peter getting out of the boat and walking on water.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason he's able to walk on water is he has this vision of Jesus on the shore.
Mm-hmm.
And he can walk on water only if he doesn't look down
mm-hmm.
at the water. And as soon as he realizes the precarious, the impossible nature
mm-hmm.
of what he's doing, he sinks. And as long as he's got his view on the clear goal, he's able to do the impossible. And it's an analogy.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I think it is. It's a deep analogy. One of the things it might imply is that when we have senses of purpose, mythic beyond self-purpose, we are suddenly capable of doing much more than we thought we were able to do before. In fact, by the way, just because my mind always works this way, and I'm realizing that there's no escape from it, in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where Sean Connery and Harrison Ford are a father and son team, and Indiana Jones has to go through a certain number of challenges and obstacles to get to the Holy Grail, there's a moment where it's just the leap of faith. And as he looks at a chasm that he's supposed to cross, he has no idea how he can do it, but it's urgent. He has to go in order to save his father's life. And he watch this moment. In fact, it's worth watching the film just for the moment, even though the whole thing is very good. He stands right at a chasm, and he has no choice. That the sense of purpose that's pushing him forward is also something he can't choose not to do. So he stands and he closes his eyes and he just lifts his foot and steps. And suddenly he realizes that there's an illusion. There's actually this very powerful illusion created where from the perspective of the person standing there, there's nothing to break the fall. But once you step on it and you shift your eyes like this, you see there's actually a bridge camouflaged into the scenery. And in fact, it's not different. The question is, do we believe the bridge is there? Do we believe that there's something that can call us in a successful way beyond where we think we are capable? Yes, exactly right. The classic example, and this is going to be a good segue, thank you for being planted. Nachshon, which by the way is the name of our first class in the preschool, they're called Nachshonim. That's the name of the class. Nachshon is a character who we are about to live his story, right? Nachshon is a character, he's one of the princes of the Israelites. when they get to the Red Sea that hasn't yet parted, they're terrified. Moses doesn't know what to do. Moses says, God, they're crying at me. And Moses says, what are you, and God says, what are you talking to me for? Go. Nachshon, according to the Midrash, this is not in the Torah itself, Nachshon jumps into the water, and as he walks forward, he starts singing Micha Mocha, and at the point where he's about to choke, because the water is not going anywhere, he keeps going, and then the water splits. He has faith, and by the way, that's why we named the preschool class this, because it didn't exist last year, and suddenly we took a leap together, as did our shul, that in the sense of purpose that drives me, miracles can happen. But in this world, in our world today, the question is, what does the word miracle imply? And I don't want to get to that yet. But a human involvement in the world that has a supernatural or something like that impact, where we create a miracle by our choices, by our convictions, by our actions, miracle takes on a very different impact. So what I want to make sure I lay out is why I chose, at least in the way that I developed the words, to not deal with biblical characters. Okay? This is Mythic People 1. But it's not biblical. And the reason for that is if we talk about miracles happening, some of us might say quite quickly, well, in the Bible miracles happen. The sea splits. There are angels. There are things that happen that I'm willing to say are biblical and therefore have nothing to do with me. I might relate to them. I might learn from them. I might read them. I might find them captivating. But there's a big difference between Adam and Eve in the garden and me. There's a big difference between Rivka pregnant with twins going to an oracle and finding out the future. There's a big difference between that and me. There's a big difference between any of those stories. Joshua and the Battle of Jericho, that's not me. It has metaphoric implications. I, as rabbi, actually invoke it every time a couple walks around each other under the chuppah, because the way to break down barriers, ultimately, is to circle each other and to create intimacy. It's not with warfare. But that's a metaphoric understanding of a biblical miracle, which is different than saying, all right, let's look at the Talmud. That exists in our realm of, quote, modern thinking. Destruction of the temple is what really pervades all of rabbinic writing, and in many ways that metaphor unfortunately continues. The whole sense of creation in the face of utter destruction is something that motivates us, as one sociologist has called us, to be the eternally dying people. Every generation sees itself as the last, and that means if I don't make this thing work, it all folds with me. Now, I don't think that's actually true, but I think that it's not a lie either. I have this ongoing nightmare, actually, in my head. And it hasn't happened in a while. I think it's because I'm too busy. But I used to have this nightmare that all the books in the world would disappear. All the books in the world would disappear. And that doesn't mean I've read them all, but it means that's part of why I read. And I think all of us have certain senses of impending loss, which lead us to do some of what we do. Now, that's not entirely true for all of us. Some of us say, oh my God, this is an amazing thing I'm doing, and there needs to be more of this in the world. But for me, at least, I have both. I've got like the celebration of hope that happens quite naturally here, and the sense, the ongoing sense that we are an anomaly in the Jewish institutional world. And I think we should stop being such an anomaly. I think people can learn from what this place has really organically created. But that means, ultimately, that we are not just members of a community. We have to see ourselves as ambassadors of an idea, which ultimately means, well, I'm working my tail off, each of us could say, to make some things in this place happen. And that's not enough, because if it only happens here, what's the point? It's the same thing as saying, around my home, we have an island of safety and hope. Once I step into the blustering world, I'm not sure it can sustain itself. And the answer is it must. But what drives me to do that sometimes is not a sense of hope. It's a sense of desperation which leads to hope. The rabbinic imagination, as we're about to encounter it, is very much wrapped up in that idea. In the year 70, the second Jerusalem temple, the Beit HaMikdash, was destroyed by the Romans. The world that had existed until that point saw the Beit HaMikdash as a culmination of the building. It was where we all got together three times a year, even if we didn't. It's where we said we got together three times a year, and everyone who could did. It's a place where commerce was centered. But more than that, it was a place where God lived. And with the burning of the stones, with the cracking of that building, and for many, even those like me, who have a problem with the icon that the Kotel has become, that it has become in some ways the object of prayer instead of the vehicle, I still weep every time I go, almost every time I go, especially because the last few times I've brought my children. With the destruction of that temple, our sense of safety in the world shattered. It disappeared. It evaporated more quickly than it had accumulated. And the rabbis who are quoted and who themselves constructed what we call Mishnah and Gemara, and I'll define those in a second for those that don't know, they were trying to dream again. They were trying to recreate a world that could no longer exist. And what they needed to do then was innovate. They needed to take the pieces that had existed, and as I say this, Shoah imagery is so present. Take the pieces of that which existed and build something beautiful with them without letting go of them. If you look actually at the Kotel, you can see different sizes of stones depending on the generation that did the building. Some are really big. Some of them are smaller. And you have to imagine, or at least I do, that some of the smaller stones actually came from the bigger stones. And that ultimately the use of them, the real recycling of the past is part of how we construct, but the people who lifted those new stones had to know where they came from and did it anyway. They didn't lose themselves saying, look at what I'm holding. This is the broken part of me. They said, no, I'm going to make it whole in some really profound way. So, just a quick definition of terms so that we can get into it. And I know that there's a lot of introduction, but the fact that we're going to get to the material is surprising, actually. I was despairing, and that made me hopeful. So, Mishnah. Mishnah was codified around the year 200 CE. It involves voices. It includes voices that existed for a long time beforehand. Mishnah, in many ways, is the next generation of Jewish writing after the Bible. It does not explicitly quote Torah, but embodies the direction that Torah, as the rabbis think, would have led. With every generation of new questions, new answers need to be presented, and the Torah was one way of framing the world. So you've got Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, all the way through Devar Yamim, which is Chronicles. But how do you answer new questions based on the old narrative, and how do new types of people find direction? Well, you reorganize it. So the six orders of Mishnah were a newly democratic way of gaining information. It didn't exactly work, but it was better. No more priests who own the way to God, but anybody can learn, and that's the way to God. Now that was codified around the year 200 CE by Judah the Prince, Yehuda HaNasi. He was the rabbi in charge of the community, as was his family. It was a dynasty. But what was also interesting about it is that it lasted very little time as the answer that was sufficient. As we know, every generation comes with its new questions. It's not just us, and it's certainly not just Berkeley, where new forms of questions come to the fore, but the way to answer it became incredibly important. So the rabbinic imagination continued on, and the democracy sort of evaporated as the text became more dense. And by the year 600 CE, the commentary on the Mishnah called the Gemara took form. It wasn't cleanly edited every time. There are lots of things that weren't included that we've begun to discover. That's why you hear about the Cairo Geniza. And Geniza means place where scraps of holy paper and parchment and objects are kept until they're buried. Sometimes we rediscover the voices from the past that weren't included in the mainstream vision. That's actually kind of exciting when we see ourselves as reconstructing religious identity. If you don't, I do. And I think that's kind of cool. All that being said, when we look at the text on our page, there are a number of things to remember. One of them is that I chose only Gemara, because if I said I'm choosing Midrash, which is the process of Jewish imagination, you might have said, oh yeah, Midrash, that's where fantasies happen. In fact, when I was studying at the Jewish Theological Seminary, undergrad and then other stuff, we skipped the parts that were narrative when we were doing Gemara. Because Gemara has both law, halacha, and agada, which we could call, agada is another word for midrash. In fact, agada is the word magid, which we'll be doing at the Seder. Magid is telling our story. We skipped the story so we could get to the legal analysis, except in a class that was dedicated to narrative. And it was a bifurcating approach, which meant that I forgot who I was as I was trying to remember what to do. It's a real problem. And in fact, one of the texts we'll look at deals with that quite directly. That being said, the texts in front of us are chosen only from Gemara, maybe as a response to my own training, but also because it's great to see mainstream thinking include these stories. What is the point of the stories? Who are the people being depicted? And did they see themselves as actually owning the story? Were they Superman? Did they see themselves as a Superman type mythic character? Did they see themselves as Spider-Man, which means born to be human and suddenly cast in by external forces into a role that suddenly they were capable of doing things they could not have seen themselves capable of before? Or were they Batman? Were they just called to an incredibly intense purpose that they couldn't escape while never being more than human? Those questions, I think, are really, really useful. The framework for reading these stories is going to be very curious. I don't know if it'll work. It's my first time trying it. But we'll try it together. So here's what I'd like us to do. By the way, any questions?
When does Talmud happen? After Gemara?
Talmud is a combination of Mishnah and Gemara. So Talmud is Mishnah plus Gemara. Mishnah, the year 200 CE, is useful as a codifying date, canonizing date. And Gemara, 600 CE-ish, is a codifying date, so Talmud is the whole thing. But when you look at a page of Talmud, it includes commentary much later than that. It's just not classically included. Hi. Sure. So, here's what I'd like us to do. What you have in front of you, by the way, the texts are not numbered in order, because I couldn't figure out which order made the most sense. But we'll do the top one on what it says, page one, it says text one, Talmud Babli. Talmud is what we were just discussing. Babli means it's the Babylonian Talmud. There is a Palestinian Talmud or a Jerusalem Talmud that was a little bit earlier and was created by different rabbis living in the land of Israel and had a different interpretation of the same Mishnah most of the time. So we have two levels here, but they're both from Masechet Brachot, the Book of Blessings, and from page 34b, if you'd ever choose to look at it yourself. You can find it online. If you type in Brachot 34b, but you can also find two easily accessible translations. One of them is the Schadenstein version of the Talmud put out by Art Scroll. Its theology is hard for me, but its Gemara is quite beautifully done. And the other one is Sansino, which is outdated, but it's sort of like reading the King James Bible. You get a feel for it, but not necessarily the precise meaning. So, okay, here's what I'd like us to do. Let's take a moment, if I could ask you to, with two or three people around you, maybe at a table, to look at the text, which is text one together. Try reading it out loud. Somebody at the table, just read it out loud, and see if we can figure out, together in small groups, how do the rabbis in the story see themselves? What's the reality of the story? What's the reality of it? You're the rabbi editing the text. How do you see yourself? What's the point of the story? So in the pursuit of mythic people, do the rabbis see themselves as mythic people? Do they believe the story they tell about themselves? Are they living the story they're telling? Okay? Those are the questions I'd like us to swirl around, and if you've got your own questions, that's great. What I'd like to do, since we don't have a huge amount of time, is give you inadequate 5 minutes to sit at the table, read the text once out loud to each other, and see what emerges, and then we'll regroup and see where we are. Okay? Here we go. What makes you say that? as you're listening, whoever's listening to this. The classes are going on in small Haruka sections, and then we will regroup, and hopefully this will be able to be edited out. Okay, I know that it's not fair, but I'm going to cut off the conversation where it is. I'm going to try. And by the way, just as a side note, I hope that as we went around, if you didn't know everybody's names, we got a chance to hear each other's names, because it's very nice to meet new mythic people as we have this conversation. All right, this text is one of a series. I want to tell you just a drop about Janina Bendoza as an introduction. He was known as a miracle worker who was also incredibly poor. He could do things for the external world, but not for himself and for his family, and that was fascinating. From week to week, they existed, according to legend, on carob the entire week. And so that the neighbors wouldn't know that they didn't have a lot, Rabbi Janina Bendoza's wife would put fuel into the oven to make them think that there was a loaf baking in it. When one of their neighbors got suspicious and looked into their home and opened the oven to which, his wife placed fuel, there were loaves of challah in it. They also were, in spite of this, desperate just to make ends meet, and so his wife asked him to collect in advance from his reward in the world to come. And so they got. This is in the Gemara also, and so he prayed for that, And when they woke up, they had a golden table leg from which they could gain sustenance. That night, his wife had a vision of the scholars in the world to come, each at a table of three legs, but her husband at a table with two. And he said, and she asked them to give it back. And they did. This kind of fluidity of vision and the interaction with the world to come is very much the background of this kind of a story.
Right.
It's important to recognize that there is a mythic context for this question. So, here we go. We've got Mishnah, we've got Gemara. Gemara has two different stories. They're similar to each other. So instead of reading them out loud together, which we have done already, what I'd like to ask us to do so that we can get to another one afterwards is, shoot, where are we? What are some of the things we noticed? What are some of the questions we started asking? Jerry?
Well, what I see here is that they come correctly. People are doing things. They're not doing them directly. They're doing them by asking God.
Okay. So Jerry, I was repeating it for recording and for everybody else, is that Jerry was saying that what seems to be happening is that the people aren't doing the thing themselves, they are asking God to do them. Okay? Yeah. By the way, that's a classic concept called theurgy. We've talked about it once before, where it could be understood as a light switch. Mishaberach is the light switch, and healing is the light. I say the Mishaberach, God heals. According to Mordechai Kaplan, the founder of Reconstructionism, that reduces God into being a demon who I can invoke and control as opposed to an infinite being that has its own path or a force that makes for salvation which is not controllable.
The Arcanism is the idea that
exactly.
You can make a statue and do some things and what you want to happen will happen.
Yes.
And that's not Judaism.
No, but Jerry, your distinction of paganism is where you make something and it does what you tell it to do.
Yeah.
It is different because Judaism doesn't say, at least in this incarnation, that we invent God and then ask God to do it.
No.
Paganism is the focusing of the natural forces through human intervention and then utilizing that.
Yeah.
The big difference is that infinity is never reduced in the Jewish framework.
What you're doing is not paganism.
Yes.
That's what I expected.
Yes, exactly right. The distinction is really, really important to make. Okay, thank you. Barry.
Ben Sarkar is Batman, and Goza is Superman.
Okay.
And I guess the part that's so unique to me, because I haven't read this kind of Gemara, is just the fact that there, at least one of them is like a superhero, a superpower.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't relate to it, and I know what the implications are. They're kind of fascinating. But the fact that the way one delivers it, there are almost differences.
Mm-hmm. It is a very interesting concept. Just so we can all hear Barry, if we didn't already, that Ben Zakkai is like Batman, and Hanina Ben Dosa is like Superman, and it's hard to relate to the Superman character. But somehow, he's born a person, you know, at least even in the understanding of the story. Yeah. Mike.
I say Hanina is not Superman at all. He is, as we mentioned at the table, he is more or less channeling God. And if God is coming through, it's clear. And it's absolutely clear God is coming through me. And being the imperfect human, he knows that if his tongue isn't fluent, God's not coming through him. It's just me, and so it's not going to happen.
Hmm.
And so it's just he has the awareness, not any superpower, just the awareness of when he's in contact with the divine and when he's not.
Hmm. Very well put. By the way, one of the interesting, there have been multiple interpretations of the whole question, the Hebrew shkura b'fiv, that the prayer is fluent in his mouth. One of the ways that it's been interpreted is that he executes well, and that's when he knows that despite being the imperfect creature that he is, as we all are, it works. He's a clear conduit. But another way that it's been understood is that he is always the imperfect conduit, but God is present and he knows it when it still feels right. The fluency is actually not in his control. The fluency is granted him. It's sort of saying divine inspiration as opposed to reaching for it. It's a very interesting question because it makes God more active in him as an external force than his ability to invoke the spirituality and the divine nature within to tap into that force. It's a very interesting question. Within the mythic understanding, where is the basis of that specialness? Because in Batman, it's internal. In Spider-Man, it comes from outside and invokes something different. Superman is very hard to relate to. Right? He's alien in that sense. He really looks like us.
I find it very interesting that he says, you know, he's not a prophet, the son of a prophet, he knows his place of appearance. Normally, when people are talking about how they know something, it's by divine something or other, you know, God spoke to him, or God gave him a sense. But it's like he's acknowledging that it's coming from somewhere else, but he's crediting his own.
Yeah, Judy's saying something I think incredibly profound, and part of what it is to be a postmodern person, which simply just means walking the streets today, is that the former assumptions that if you knew something divine, it's because God gave it to you, that's very different than what he's saying. I'm not a prophet nor the son of a prophet. I know this from experience. You know, if you were at the protest at the Olympic torch relay, like, you were in the presence of a prophet whose name was Ruth Messenger, and a lot of other prophets who were there, filling up the space. And Abraham Joshua Heschel was another one of those people, as was Martin Luther King Jr., and some people would say Gandhi. I mean, some of these spiritual virtuosos who find themselves so in tune with the world, so sensitive, intensely sensitive to the suffering of the world, that they learn from experience what it is to act in the name of God, whatever they mean by the sentence. I think ultimately to be acutely aware of the world in all of its intensity and to respond to it with a sense not of confidence but of call. I mean, I don't know that I use his phrase in a literal sense. I know from experience that I know that my prayer is working if it's working. Because I don't even know what it means for a prayer to work. Let alone to invoke divine healing. Except that I know sometimes Amisha Berach creates something really powerful. Sometimes. I think you're pointing to something really intense, which is the human ownership of that divine communication. That's radical. Judith.
Well, part that I think about is somehow when that word can come through is when we've been able to get ourselves out of the way. So when you just spoke of the call, that we all have flaws, we're human, but somehow the things that would stop us, we can let go of, we can get out of the way of them so that we can receive the call and respond to it. We can feel the suffering and respond directly to it.
Yeah. It's, for those who didn't hear Judith, and I'm going to misphrase it, you said that very eloquently. The idea that we get us out of the way so that we can respond with clarity to the thing that's calling. And that's one of the reasons I said not confidence, but call, actually. Heschel said, actually, that the worst sin is to forget that we are a bridge to the divine. And it's really easy to forget, in fact, because I'm busy paying taxes.
Or looking at our flaws.
Yeah, or saying, oh, my hair is messed up.
Or I'm not good enough.
Right, I didn't want to get deep yet. Yes. Okay. This is obviously not exhaustive on the first text. And I don't want to answer that first question yet. I don't know that I have one. But let's ask the question out loud and then move on. The question out loud could be, what do the rabbis believe of themselves as they tell these stories? Okay, so I want to hold on to that question. Next text, I would just want to read out loud, taking advantage of sort of the limited time and the fact that I just get to do it. Even though it says next, I said next text, it's text 4. That's on the same side as what we just read. This is one of the classic stories. If you look up rabbinic wonder workers or miracle workers, you get the story of Choni HaMe'agel, Choni the circle drawer. By the way, if you're looking for a few extra resources, you can go to the website listed at the top of the page. I've posted 3 links to different articles, but you can, of course, go to Google and say, Rabbi, Miracle Worker. You'll find a million sites on Jesus, and then you'll find a lot of things on other people. But if you limit it by writing Torah, you'll find 600,000 that are still all about Jesus. So, okay. Talmud Bavli, same original corpus of text. Masechet Ta'anit, which is the book about fasting, which is actually not the book of fasting, it's a book of how to respond to drought. As an agricultural society, the time that you call out to God most intensely is when you think your whole world is evaporated. The water is gone. Rain is really the way to make this happen. And in modern day Israel and in the surrounding countries, that is still the case. The most incredible and missed partnership that's going on is Jordan and Israel trying to work with the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, in desalinization processes because the lack of water in the region is shared. Anyway, that's a political soapbox, but here we go. This is from Masechet Ta'anit. One year, the winter brought no rain to Jerusalem. And Jerusalem, of course, destroyed Jerusalem, you have to say. And even if this text is older, it's being codified by those who know that Jerusalem is in ruins. Toward the end of Adar, that is, well after Purim, maybe even close to today, that year, the people summoned Choni to intercede for them. When his prayers elicited no sign of divine grace, Choni drew a circle and stepped inside. Lord of the universe, he said, your children have placed their trust in me because I am like a member of your family. Believe me, I will not leave the circle till you show some compassion. It began to drizzle. Whereupon the people said to Choni, seeing you, we will surely not die, but it does appear to us that this drizzle is sent merely to comply nominally with your oath. Choni turned to God. This is not what I sought. I asked for a rain that would fill pits, ditches, and caves. Aqueducts is another way of saying that. This time it rained furiously till each drop bore a barrel of water. Again, the people protested. Seeing you, we will surely not die. But it does appear to us as if this rain is sent only to destroy the world. Again, Choni addressed God, this is not what I sought. I asked for a rain of goodwill and blessing, freely given. Finally, it rained normally and steadily until the people were obliged to take refuge on the Temple Mount, which no longer held, by the time of the codification of this text, a safe space. And now they asked Choni to bring the rain to an end. Despite some reservations, Choni acceded to their urging with the following insight offered in prayer over a Thanksgiving Balak. And the reason I bring the story, well, leave that line out, I should have edited it out. Lord of the universe, your people Israel, which you took out of Egypt, cannot endure too much of a good thing or too much punishment. If you are angry with them, they cannot make it. If you are generous with them, they cannot make it. So may it be your will to stop the rain and give the world a respite. Once the rain had ended, the people went into the fields to find them already sprouting with mushrooms. Now, this is an adaptation of the original source, but not a departure from its telling. Choni and other miracle workers are typically despised by the rabbis, partially because they sound a little bit too much like a Galilean rabbi who was told to have been involved in miracles. Loaves, fish, wine, water. Right? He who must not be named is the way the Talmud would have referred to him, as J.K. Rowling refers to Voldemort, the bad guy in Harry Potter. You don't say his name, but you make sure it's not of repute to talk about what he does. Anyone who does stuff like him is not to be held in high regard. Choni is totally demolished later in the rabbinic imagination, but this story is included. If we were doing biblical analysis, we would use someone like Bilam, the wizard, the sorcerer, who actually should be known as Bilam the prophet, because he does have incredible power. He is a non-Israelite prophet who was hired to curse the Israelite people. Why? Not because he's a charlatan, but because he can really do it. And the divine power is out there to be used by human beings, by asking God for it. Right? What's interesting in this text is Choni can do it all. And he's in the family of God. Still asks God, but I am family of God, and that's why people ask me. That's one step away from saying, I am the son of God, and I have a conduit. I'm a human being, but I'm not. It's sort of like looking at Hercules in Greek mythology. Hercules is both human and not, needs to prove that the half of him that is divine is worthy by accomplishing superhuman tasks, but he's not a god yet. And so defeating the Hydra, all the different things that he did, is in large part to prove that he's not human. Choni proves in some way, maybe, that he's not exactly human. He's a little bit too Superman-y to be relatable. I can't draw a circle and make this thing happen. It's a good story. But it's told as history in the face of drought, which is very real. So I want to leave that for a second and turn over. Okay. Here are two shorter ones, but they're so beautiful. And come as, here's another phrase, ideological myth. An ideology tells why something exists the way it does. We talked about this in our first conversation, where the sun's path is mysterious. And since the world revolves around the earth, as we all know, what's that thing going around us? Right? Rabbinic imagination, or earlier than that? Well, it's Apollo's chariot. Or as we say in Maariv, Umavir Yomu Mevi Laila, God brings the night and brings the day. God turns the universe around us, or God makes time change. However we would choose to translate it. We're not so far away from it. Here are two ideological stories. The first one I find incredibly compelling because, well, I do. You might not. The other ones are also quite compelling. Could someone just read the one that's numbered text 2 on the top of the page out loud?
Yabash Ishmael and Elisha said, I once entered into the innermost part of the sanctuary to offer incense to Akatriel Yah, the Lord of hosts, seated upon a high and exalted throne. God said to me, Ishmael, my son, bless me. I replied, May it be a will that your mercy may suppress your anger and your mercy may prevail over your other attributes so that you may deal with your children according to the attribute of mercy and may on their behalf and go beyond the limit of strict justice. God nodded to me with God's head. From here we learn that the blessing of an ordinary person must not be considered lightly in your eyes.
Thank you. If all we had was the last line, we'd still be moved. By the way, you might think that the vision of God sitting in a high and lofty throne is distinctly not Jewish feeling. And then you read the 6th chapter of Isaiah. And Isaiah has the same vision. In fact, we say it every time we do the Kedushah. Like, Nikadesh Shimcha Ba'olam, Keshem Shemati Shimato B'Shmei Marom. We will exalt God the way they do it. They exalt God's name, Bishmei Marom, in the highest of the heavens. Right? Akisei Ram Venisa, we say that. That's a high and lofty throne. How does Rabbi Ishmael see himself in this story? And how do the codifiers of the Gemara see Rabbi Ishmael, who's a contemporary with other names, who give normative rules? Here's how you do Shabbat. Here's how you keep kosher. Here's the talit that you should be wearing. Here's how you treat each other. Here's how you shecht an animal. Here's what it was to see God face to face. One more. This one is from Masechet Megillah. It mostly deals with Purim. Anyone want to read the one that's number text 3?
Rabba and Rabbi Zara made a Purim feast together. They got drunk. Rabba stood up and killed Rabbi Zara. On the morrow, Rabba prayed for him and resurrected him. The following year, Rabba said to him, come, let us celebrate the Purim feast together. Rabbi Zara replied, miracles don't happen every day.
The last line actually in the Hebrew is Ein Somchim Al Anes. It's actually really, really famous if you're learning Talmud in the original. It's a really well-known phrase. It means you don't rely on a miracle. But another way of saying this, miracles don't happen every day. Now, it's fun to read, right? It also tells you not to get drunk. What does it also tell you? Not to hang around people who are drunk, for sure.
A miracle may happen, but don't depend on it.
A miracle could happen, but don't depend on it. That's one of the messages. But if we take this as a polemic against early Christianity, what might it say?
I said resurrection is not necessarily in the cards.
Resurrection is not necessarily in the cards. In fact, it might not exist at all. There's a retelling of this story elsewhere which says they pretended to do this in front of another rabbi so that it was like a Purim prank. But the point of this telling of the story is, hey, don't count on resurrection. That's not real. I'm not getting together at your party. It's a different kind of ideology depending on the way that you should to read it. So, yes? Were they fighting with each other? Why did he kill him? I think because they were drunk. That's the only thing we know about them. Either it was a prank, as we hear in another version of the story, or they're just not in control of themselves and lose morality.
But it was Haman.
But it was what?
He thought it was Haman.
The reason for doing it is important, obviously, but what's most important for the text is where it goes, which is to say, no, I'm not doing that again. I'm not getting involved in a situation where you see yourself as a miracle worker. In the most mystically leaning of the Orthodox world in Judaism, there is a general idea that any rabbi mentioned in the Gemara had the ability to resurrect.
Wow.
I remember learning that in yeshiva. Now that's not widespread. That's not mainstream. I doubt that anybody who we know that would affiliate with the Orthodox world would take that to be true, except that there is a general idea that they had incredible powers. Part of it is the concept that since Sinai, every generation is one step down, called Yiridat Hadorot. But there's also the concept that these stories embody deep power that they actually had. Glenn.
Don't let go of responsibility.
Right. For those who heard Glenn, or for those who didn't hear Glenn, the other part of the story is don't let go of responsibility. But the other way of saying that is don't think that God is going to act in this world just because you want the healing thing to happen. Right. In fact, one of the messages that I said yesterday in my drasha was part of that point, which was to say, once upon a time we would say, even though the Messiah may tarry, I'll wait. That was what we used to say. We still sing that song. That's Ani Ma'amin. I believe that the Messiah will come. David Hartman and many other people, including Yitz Greenberg and a lot of just wonderful teachers, have said that the covenant has changed. The founding of the State of Israel is a moment in Jewish history where we didn't wait for the Messiah. It represents a theological step. And even if we don't involve the founding of the State of Israel in that, though I do, it's possible to say that we don't wait for God to make the world a better place. That doesn't work anymore. The prophets within hear the call in such a way that they suddenly get out of the way so that they can do it. Because without the people doing it, as Brad Artson, the rabbi who was here for the installation, he's used the phrase many times. I didn't realize it when he said it about me, and I was terrified, but I realized he said it about a universal statement of human potentiality, that we are each eruptions of the divine. And the problem is the volcano gets capped.
Is there a couple of things that these two writings bring up for me? One is the difference between divine inspiration versus like supernatural, superstitious kind of stuff. And it's always fascinating for me when we're getting right and get into things like supernatural, superstitious kind of stuff. And the other thing, going back to the earlier one before this, about God asking Rabbi Ishmael to bless him.
Yeah.
That takes you a whole kind of fascinating area in Judaism.
Yeah.
What does that mean, you know, on all these different levels? So I just wanted to toss those out.
Yeah. Let me only re-raise what you just said and then say that's for maybe a next conversation. God willing. May it be God's will to give us the opportunity to continue the conversation. Yeah, in fact, I think that's part of the response, Barry. If you didn't hear Judy, she just said it's our responsibility to make sure it happens. Right? The question of God asking for a blessing reformulates the whole relationship. It is not a perfect God, because what we could say is, God already has everything God needs. God doesn't need sacrifice, God doesn't need a shul, God doesn't need any particular religious faith as long as we live life in a unified, purposeful, holy way. But the particulars of it is what this text is calling for. The particulars include specific formula of blessing. What is it I think that God, which might represent a healthy universe, what is it that I can contribute as a particular, but that understands the universe as vulnerable and doesn't keep God distant from the universe? There's no distance in a certain sense. The transcendent God is not the one that I'm talking about. I'm talking about one whose destiny is very much wrapped up in the world that we see. It's not pantheism, which is a pagan approach. It might be panentheism, which is that God is within every aspect of reality. And that means with the blessing I make, this is Luriana Kabbalah, with the blessing that I make on my coffee, I'm actually releasing the potentiality of that coffee so that it's not a wasteful act. When we use the compost bin, and we choose to get more expensive cutlery, which isn't actually cutting anything well, and we put it into the compost bin, what we're saying is I don't want to waste this spark. And by releasing it, the world becomes more purposeful. That's not only Jewish. But to do that with a Jewish voice means that my distinctiveness is actually what binds me to the whole. But my choice to live in a distinct way, in a purposeful and distinct way, without ignoring the whole, is actually what makes, I think, each of us qualified to be a mythic person. I don't think there are radioactive spiders waiting to turn us into something we're not. I don't think any of us come from Krypton. But I do think that the world, in some ways, calls us to respond with extreme compassion, with boundless gratitude, and that Batman's traumatic beginning need not be ours, but we have enough traumatic beginnings that we could point to as motivations to do good in the world. And that means, ultimately, we could be mythic people. What we're going to talk about in the next conversation, which is going to be sort of Eastern European versions of these stories, is how did the story change? But I want just to, I'm going to end cleanly and then I won't leave quickly. But I want to make sure that we can be respectful of time. The two columns at the bottom of the page come from a wonderful book which is up in our library. This one is actually my copy. Louis Ginsburg was sort of an old school thinker in the conservative rabbinate. The word conservative wasn't really popular. He wrote Legends of the Jews. It was translated actually by someone who was in love with him, who he didn't return her love, and she founded Hadassah. Her name was Henrietta Zold. There's a lot of controversy about their relationship. He would have been the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary after Solomon Schechter, except that Matilda Schechter loved Henrietta Zold and was mad at him. And it's not as simple as that, but it's a fascinating way of telling a story. It's a mythic retelling. But they accomplished enormous good in the world. Louis Ginsburg was also the one who saw liberal rabbis and says, gentlemen, hands off the halacha. So he is someone, because there was a conversation about including instrumental music at that point in organ. There were conversations of mixed pews. There's a whole compendium of responses put together by David Galenkin, which if you're looking for, I have and is interesting page by page. Here we go. Yeah, I'm going to steamroll to the end and then I won't leave. So, here we go. This is on the significance of the halakha, but he starts with this really interesting thing. So the second paragraph on the left. With your permission, I shall commence my lecture. This was translated, by the way, by Arthur Hertzberg. It was originally written in German. With your permission, I shall commence my lecture by recounting an incident that happened to me. It is a memory from boyhood, which means the time when I had already been liberated from the hard discipline of the master of the cheder school, and yet, though a child of 9, had begun to study in the traditional phrase by myself. He was studying Talmud in the original by himself at age 9. He was one of those, or at least he wanted to be thought of as one of those, and he was actually incredibly, incredibly gifted. He was a brilliant person. I was then studying the tractate Baba Batra, that's in the Gemara, same what we were studying before. When I reached the tales of Rabba Bar Bar Chana, doubts began to disturb my mind. My peace was particularly troubled by those geese, who were so fat that they had streams of oil flowing from them, and by the bird that was so big that the waters of the sea reached only to its ankles and its head split the heavens. My joy was great when I came across a book by one of, quote, the enlightened of the older generation, from which I learned that these geese were neither fat nor thin, and that the giant bird possessed neither feet nor wings, but that the whole tale was merely a flight of the imagination, or, as the ancient used to say, it was only a parable. The moral I have forgotten. I was a child then, but when I reached maturity, I realized that in truth, the geese of Rabba Bar Bar Chana were real geese. And the giant bird was literally a bird. When regarded as natural creations of the folk imagination, they lost their strangeness and incomprehensibility. On the contrary, it would be all the more strange if we possessed no such tales. In that case, it would be extremely difficult to explain so striking a difference between our people and all others. One involving so great a triumph of reason over imagination that the latter had become completely atrophied. he then draws in the next paragraph the difference between halakha, which guides us in what we do, and agadah, which helps us understand who we are. His last sentence is where I want to look. Second to last sentence. Even if it be a true distinction that the agadah, that the narrative, the mythic telling, is the realm of spirit, and the halakha is in the realm of life, what you do, one must remember that all impulses for human action are spiritual. For there can be no valid life which is not based on the spirit. The halakha, therefore, includes not only the realm of life, but also the realm of spirit. This is a tremendous text, and I want to be able to talk about this more, but for now, I thank Art for including this conversation, I thank you for showing up, and if you have questions either or comments about this or Pesach, I'm not leaving quickly. Have a wonderful, wonderful day. Yeah.